This episode is brought to you by The Syllabus, a nonprofit knowledge discovery service doing artisanal automation. How does that work? Well, they use technology to monitor thousands of sources, and each week, human curators, that is actual people, handpick the best of what's been published on the internet. When you sign up, you get to set up your feed. You'll pick from 6 languages and 60 topics like far-right populism or energy and extractivism, heterodox economics or AI and automation. Everything's there. Each Monday, you'll get a new batch of personalized recommendations. And it's not just podcasts. It's essays and books, academic articles and reports, and even videos. And I believe, dear friends, that American Prestige and even maybe Daniel Bessner himself has been featured on The Syllabus. So check out their website, the-syllabus.com. And there's a hyphen between the and syllabus. That was the dash I said. They offer 2-week free trials. And if you enter Prestige at checkout, you'll get 30% off your first year. And to remember, that's Prestige, P-R-E-S-T-I-G-E. And you enter that at checkout for 30% off your first year.
That's kind of conversation to your soul. That's conversation to your soul.
Hello, Prestige Heads, and welcome to American Prestige. I'm Danny Bessner, here as always with my friend and comrade Derek Davison, and we are excited to bring you the news. But before we get going, I just want to do a little bit of housekeeping. This is the first episode that we're going to do by video. Basically, each week we're going to post our news episodes on YouTube, and we're also going to do a new feature. So as you might know, we've started a Discord, which you can join if you're a subscriber. Basically, people can leave questions for us in our Discord, and each week, Derek and I will do a video discussing one of the questions. So please look to the show notes for a link to our YouTube page, a link to our Discord, and as always, a link to subscribe. Now on to the news. Derek, let's start with Ukraine, and let's talk about Trump and Putin, who have agreed to start peace talks.
Yes, the president of the United States and the president of Russia are going to negotiate the end of the war in Ukraine. You'll notice the Ukrainians aren't involved. Who knows if that's going to stick? We'll see. But Donald Trump and Vladimir Putin did talk by phone on Wednesday. This was the first time, at least acknowledged time, that they've interacted one-on-one since Trump took office again. Trump has intimated or hinted around about the possibility that they've talked on other occasions, but nobody's openly acknowledged that if those conversations have even taken place. But on Wednesday, they did, and this came in the midst of a prisoner exchange. A U.S. school teacher named Mark Fogel, who was in Russian prison on drug charges, was released. The U.S. released a Russian cyber criminal named Alexander Vinnik, who had pled guilty to conspiracy to commit money laundering and was in U.S. custody. So this was in the context of this prisoner exchange taking place. That Trump and Putin had this phone call on Wednesday and agreed, according to Trump, to I'm quoting here, have our respective teams start negotiations immediately as far as ending the war in Ukraine. As I say, you may note that there was no Ukrainian involvement here. Trump did call, I guess, after that, Volodymyr Zelensky, the president of Ukraine, to let him know the good news. Zelensky seems pretty hesitant, as you might expect, that this was all being done without his involvement or even knowledge. They didn't get into any detail about how these negotiations are going to start, who's going to be involved. As I say, it's not even clear that there's going to be Ukrainian representation. It might just be U.S. and Russia, who knows. Trump did mention that he and Putin are going to meet face-to-face, he thinks, in the near future, probably in Saudi Arabia, because who doesn't want to take a little swanky trip to Saudi Arabia to have a meeting with the president of Russia? Again, we don't really know what the parameters of that conversation are going to be, but this seems to be a pretty momentous development that we're going to start seeing peace talks related to Ukraine pretty soon. Who knows where they will lead, I guess, is all I can say at this point.
Derek, what's your sense of where DC is vis-a-vis Ukraine these days?
I think people were not ready for this. There was a lot of kind of white knuckling during the campaign when Trump would talk about Ukraine and talk about resolving the war in 24 hours. He would, insisted that he could do it in a day. Sometimes would say even before he became president, like he'd do it in the lame duck period as he was, prior to his inauguration, he could get it done no problem. There was a lot of nervousness about what that might look like in terms of essentially selling Ukraine down the river. I mean, we can talk about U.S. national interests as well, but the concern from the most charitable interpretation is that you would be doing a peace deal about Ukraine that affects Ukraine without Ukrainian involvement. As time went on, as we got closer to Inauguration Day, Trump and his people started dropping the 24-hour thing, started talking about maybe 6 months, maybe longer. It's going to take a while to negotiate a settlement to the war. And in the meantime, they made it clear that Trump would more or less continue. Now, there's quirks with Trump that weren't there with Joe Biden, but more or less continue to support Ukraine militarily, financially to some extent, because otherwise the negotiating position, obviously going into these talks in 6 months or however long it would take, would be much weaker. And Trump is the deal guy, so he's got to have some idea of how to negotiate with leverage. And so I think people may have relaxed a little bit on this front, but this brings back, I think, everybody's worst fears about Trump and Putin just sitting in a room and Putin rattling off a list of demands and Trump saying, okay, okay, okay. Because really, at the end of the day, it's not the U.S. that's going to be losing anything from this. The U.S. has gained a lot of arms sales. It's gained whittling down the Russian military to a significant extent. So, if this province of Ukraine or that province of Ukraine winds up under Russian control, that's really no skin off the United States' backside. So the concern is that Trump would just kind of sell the store away and would be all to the at the cost of the Ukrainian government. And I think that's where people are at, again, kind of freaking out about that possibility.
And what's the potential fallout for Ukraine? You already referenced it, but what could we expect to see besides losing territory?
Yeah, I mean, the worst case scenario, I think, for Ukraine would be not just losing territory, but having no real guarantees. And we're going to get into what Pete Hegseth said at the Ukraine Defense Contact Group meeting. But it would be Ukraine having basically no security guarantees. No peacekeepers, no NATO membership, which, I think we both agree is far-fetched anyway, but nothing to ensure that, basically the day after the deal is signed and we all turn over, 20% of Ukraine to Russia, that the Russian army won't just start. I mean, that's not going to happen either. That's the far-fetched scenario, but the possibility exists that at some point, the Russians will decide they would like another chunk of Ukraine and we'll be, right back in the situation. And there's nothing to guarantee to the Ukrainians that this is the end of the conflict and will stay that way, indefinitely. So I think that's the worst case, the continuation of the conflict as a low level kind of open bleeding frontier. Is another problem that would affect Ukrainian domestic politics. Certainly, any deal that looks like a full-on surrender to Russia is going to affect Zelensky's standing. It's going to cause some elements within the Ukrainian social fabric, let's say, to be quite upset. So, all of these things are areas of concern for Ukrainian government, for Ukrainians in general, really.
Thank you, Derek. Let's talk about what did Pete Hegseth say about Europe?
So
that's going to be such a fucking difficult name to say. Oh my God.
Hegseth, who became Secretary of Defense in a 50-50 vote that had to be broken, I think, by J.D. Vance, quite a rallying figure, former Fox and Friends host, weekend host, Pete Hegseth, attended a meeting of the Ukraine Defense Contact Group at NATO headquarters on Wednesday. He stayed for a meeting of NATO defense ministers, I believe, on Thursday, and really kind of revealed a lot, I think, about how the Trump administration actually views this conflict. He called the Ukrainian government's goal of recovering all of its territory, and that includes not just the territory that's been seized since 2022, but going all the way back to 2014, which means Crimea, it means the very, you know, far eastern parts of the Donbas, called that illusionary. He went on to characterize the idea of Ukraine joining NATO as not realistic, which I think was a bit of a wake-up call to the Europeans. And, you know, there are other aspects of what he was talking about that are go deeper than just Ukraine. You know, I think probably things that if you really pressed anybody who's been observing the war, they would agree that the idea that Ukraine's going to get back to its 2014 boundaries is pretty far-fetched, and that Ukraine is going to, the idea that Ukraine's going to join NATO anytime soon, if ever, also a bit of a long shot. The question I think that a lot of people have is how wise it was to just say these things out loud before any negotiation has started. Again, thinking about leverage and the art of the deal, as it were, if that was really a smart thing to do, but we'll have to see, I guess.
The U.S. is prioritizing deterring war with China in the Pacific, recognizing the reality of scarcity and making the resourcing trade-offs to ensure deterrence does not fail. As the United States prioritizes its attention to these threats, European allies must lead from the front.
Hegseth did go into detail both on Wednesday and Thursday about the way that the Trump administration views Europe more broadly. He talked about the future, any future support to Ukraine having to come from European governments, overwhelmingly was the term he used, that they must provide the lion's share of any future aid to Ukraine. He also talked about the Trump administration rebalancing U.S. interests to the Pacific, preparing for war with China. This is what he said, and argued that if European countries want European security, then they have to be the ones who are responsible for it, not the U.S. They can't continue to rely on the U.S. as a security blanket. So this would be, I mean, again, things that are not entirely surprising or even necessarily wrong. I think a lot of people would agree that Europe needs to take more responsibility for its own defense and stop relying on the United States. But, you know, to have them just splayed out in very stark terms less than a month into the new administration may have set off some alarm bells in Europe. And it probably shouldn't have, because we've been through this once before. And Donald Trump was famously not terribly enamored of the NATO alliance his first time around, and, you know, kind of got reined in, I think, by some of the so-called adults in the room in his administration. But you would think that European governments would have been ready for this, but I don't think they were. So we'll see how they respond.
Let's move on to Israel-Palestine, and let's talk about Hamas threatening to delay the next hostage release.
So on Monday, Hamas announced that it was suspending further hostage releases until further notice in response to what it said were Israeli violations of the terms of the current truce, the first phase of this ceasefire agreement that was negotiated last month, or was agreed to last month. The complaints include that the Israeli military, the IDF, is continuing to attack Palestinians despite ostensibly being under state of truce, which is undeniably true. The Israelis have killed dozens of people in Gaza since the truce went into effect. They claim that in all of these incidents, the Palestinians who they killed were acting suspiciously or in a threatening way toward Israeli forces. You can take that for what it's worth. Hamas was also complaining that the IDF has interfered with the return of civilians to northern Gaza, which is also undeniably true. The Israelis delayed the opening of the roads from southern Gaza to northern Gaza in a dispute over hostages, the hostage release schedule. So that's clearly been the case. But the big complaint, I think, is that the Israelis are hampering the shipment of aid into Gaza. And this is not in an overall sense, the level of aid that's getting into Gaza since the truce went into effect is vastly larger than what was getting in prior to that. But the concern is that particular types of aid, and this especially includes shelter items, so things that you would use to construct durable facilities for displaced persons, have just not been coming in to the extent that they're supposed to under the ceasefire agreement. And the Israelis have denied, you know, interfering with this, but it seems to be a definite pattern. And so Hamas, as I say, on Monday said, enough is enough. We're not doing any more hostage releases or hostage exchanges, prisoner exchanges, until the Israelis remedy the situation. I think the main thing was in terms of the aid shipments. The Israelis responded, well, Donald Trump actually responded first, saying basically that if all of the hostages, not just the three who would be scheduled to be released this Saturday, but all of them were not released by noon on Saturday, that he would consider the ceasefire null and void and the Israelis were free to do as they like. Benjamin Netanyahu seized on that to declare that he was prepared to resume the annihilation of Gaza and its people, you know, if Hamas didn't release the hostages on Saturday. Now, he was vague about it. He didn't say all the hostages. He said our hostages, which could mean anything from, as I say, the three who would be scheduled to be released under the terms of the ceasefire agreement to everybody. Releasing everybody is not going to happen without a durable peace deal, and that's not in place and may never be in place. So, you know, there's been a back and forth for a couple of days. Hamas sent a delegation to Egypt to discuss the situation and kind of discuss their concerns. It looks like we may be reaching a resolution as of Wednesday. The Egyptians had told, Egyptian mediators had told, I think, a Qatari newspaper that they'd made considerable progress in addressing Hamas's concerns. There have been reports of an influx of aid of the type, the structural kind of housing materials getting into Gaza in the last couple of days. So that seems to be something that's being worked on. And Hamas on Thursday announced that it was committed to maintaining the schedule that's been established already. So that would mean another three hostages, October 7th hostages released on Saturday in return for a number of Palestinians who are in administrative detention, being held in administrative detention by the Israeli government. Whether that's going to resolve this or we're now into a new phase where Donald Trump has opened his mouth and queered the whole deal, we won't know maybe until Saturday. I haven't seen any comment from the Israeli government yet on Hamas's announcement on Thursday. So it looks like the pieces may be in place to continue things as before, and this crisis would be averted, but I can't say that for sure.
Crisis averted? Maybe. All right, let's talk about Trump, who is still pushing for the United States to take over Gaza.
Right. This is, I think, underpinning even, you know, going deeper than the Hamas's concerns about the aid and what type of aid and how much of it is getting into Gaza. It's likely that they have a pretty good sense at this point of two things. One, that Benjamin Netanyahu is not serious about negotiating the second phase of the ceasefire arrangement. I don't even think he has a negotiating team in Qatar at this point. He sent one and then pulled it back as all of this kind of fuss was happening this week. So I'm not even sure the Israelis are participating anymore. But he's made it clear several times in public statements that he has no interest in negotiating the second phase, and he wants to return to fighting in 3 weeks anyway, or return to, you know, the genocide in 3 weeks. The other thing that I think may be dawning on Hamas is that when Donald Trump blurted out during his when he was hosting Netanyahu at the White House, that he wanted to take over Gaza and turn it into a luxury U.S. resort colony, empty it of its population and send them to who knows where, that he wasn't joking, that he really is serious about this. At the time, it seemed ridiculous. It still seems ridiculous in terms of how you're actually going to get this done. And yet he won't stop talking about it. He refers to Gaza as a real estate development. He's planning on, you know, just moving these people out to, he continues to fixate on Egypt and Jordan, even though both of those countries have rejected the idea of participating in the ethnic cleansing of Gaza or taking in hundreds of thousands of new refugees. And yet Trump has threatened to cut off aid to both countries if they don't comply with what he wants to do. So, you know, I think underpinning the threat to end the ceasefire deal or end the truce by ending the hostage exchange a portion of it is the idea that, like, this is all going to end in ethnic cleansing anyway. We might as well just get back to fighting. Like, what's the point? And Netanyahu certainly seems emboldened by what Trump has said. He seems, you know, thrilled beyond belief that you have a U.S. president actually openly talking about ethnically cleansing Gaza, which is beyond, you know, I think his wildest dreams. He feels, I think, if he had any trepidation about not negotiating the second phase of the ceasefire deal, and that Trump might be angry with that, or Trump might have staked anything on continuing the ceasefire, then certainly he doesn't feel that way anymore. So this is all providing cover for him to just walk away from the table. Netanyahu, even at one point on, I think, last Thursday, expressed in an interview that, you know, if they want to set up a Palestinian state, they should do it in Saudi Arabia because there's a lot of land there. Well, of course, the Saudis didn't like that talk, and the Saudis are supposed to be the end game here, the normalization deal between Israel and Saudi Arabia. The Saudis, every time Netanyahu opens his mouth or Trump opens his mouth to talk about Gaza, the Saudis get more recalcitrant in their demand that there be a Palestinian state before there's any talk of normalization. So, you know, that may be working against Trump's plans at this point. But, you know, I really don't know. This whole notion of taking over Gaza, it's like you expected Trump to propose it, and then, like everything else, or, you know, most other things that he says, to kind of be walked back. And his administration has tried to walk it back. They've tried to say, well, look, this would just be a temporary relocation, or it's just while the reconstruction is going on. It's not, you know, not meant to be a permanent thing. But Trump keeps saying, no, it's going to be permanent. They're never going to be allowed to go back. We're going to build them, you know, a city or cities or, you know, places to live someplace else. And that'll be that. And we'll take over the territory and run it how we want. So it just won't die. He refuses to let it die. And it's, I think, causing a lot of challenges for diplomacy right now.
Wow. Trump wasn't a peace bringer. What a surprise. Although, I guess, TBD. Who could have predicted? Let's move on to Lebanon, and let's talk about the new government that was installed.
This was over the weekend. Nawaf Salam, who is now officially the new prime minister of Lebanon, unveiled a cabinet. This is on Saturday. It's almost 2 years at this point. In May, it would have been 2 years after Lebanon's last parliamentary election. So just a bit of a delay in getting the government together. Salam seems to have tried, at least, who knows how well he did, but he tried to thread the needle between demands that he was getting from the Trump administration, which was down to the level of, like, picking specific cabinet appointments for him. I mean, or at least demanding that Hezbollah and its parliamentary allies, the Amal movement in particular, the other Shia main Shia party, not be allowed to name specific cabinet ministries. They were talking about the finance ministry, just intervening on that level. Salam ultimately allowed Amal to name the finance minister. So it kind of went against the Trump administration's wishes. But the way the cabinet is structured, Amal, Hezbollah, that sort of group of parties does not have a particularly large position. It doesn't have a significant number of cabinet ministries. It can't, for example, doesn't have enough cabinet seats or control of enough cabinet members to block any, you know, there's certain decisions that have to be taken with a supermajority of cabinet members behind them. So there's 24 cabinet members that would require 16 votes in favor, and you could block it with more than that. The Amal Hezbollah bloc does not have enough seats to unilaterally kind of step in and block things like that. So they are weakened. The Hezbollah seems to be weakened in this new government, but whether it's enough for the Trump administration, I don't know. Still, you know, a huge I think, milestone for a country that has been floundering in complete political dysfunction for, as I say, almost 2 years at this point.
And the IDF looks like it's extending its occupation.
I know this comes as a surprise to everybody, including myself. But yes, the Israeli military, which has already had its late January deadline to withdraw from southern Lebanon extended once to February 18th, is now asking for an additional delay beyond February 18th to who knows when. I've seen a number of dates bandied around February 28th or going all the way into early April after Ramadan and the Eid holiday that follows. But clearly they don't want to leave yet. They've appealed to the United States and presumably been given permission already to stick around. The U.S. is acting ostensibly as a guarantor of the Israel-Hezbollah ceasefire, which was signed in November. In reality, as it usually does, it's acting as Israel's lawyer. But the Lebanese government has rejected, as far as I can tell, completely any extension beyond February 18th. Nabi Berri, the Amal party leader and parliament speaker, one of the three preeminent figures in Lebanese politics, told reporters on Thursday that he had delivered an absolute rejection of any extension to the U.S. government. According to him, the Israelis had said they needed an extension in five specific places. I don't know what they were, if they were five villages, five areas. I don't know any more detail than that. But that they were going to pull out of most of the region by February 18th, but they wanted extensions for these five specific places. And the U.S., who knows, probably gave them, as I say, gave them permission. But Berri said, absolutely not. We want them out completely by February 18th. Whether the Lebanese government actually has any say in whether or not the Israeli military continues to occupy Lebanese territory remains to be seen. It may be that this decision is out of their hands. So, we'll have to wait and see how that plays out.
Yeah, we'll keep you updated. Let's talk about Israel, which might strike Iran, according to the Washington Post.
Yes, this was a piece in the Washington Post on Wednesday based on U.S. intelligence information that essentially Israel is looking at some point in the first half of 2025 to strike Iranian nuclear facilities directly, which would be a first time. Obviously, we've seen Israel strike Iranian targets a couple of times since the October 7th attacks set off the regional conflagration. But this would be the first direct attack on Iranian nuclear facilities. They would strike, according to the Post, they would strike both the Natanz and Fordow facilities, both of which do uranium enrichment activities to produce material that could, if it's spun up enough, enriched highly enough, be used in bomb making. The Iranians have not done that. They've not manufactured any weapons-grade uranium. They have not, by all accounts, made any decisions about weaponizing their nuclear program. But this would be an attempt to set them back to some degree. It's unclear how far back you could set them with airstrikes. They are reportedly pitching the U.S. government at this point to greenlight an opportunity or strike these strikes. This kind of puts Trump at a bit of a crossroads because, of course, he campaigned. I mean, you know, whether he's living up to it, but he campaigned on the idea of being a peacemaker. He has on multiple occasions suggested that he wants to negotiate with the Iranians. He wants to negotiate specifically on Iran's nuclear program. Even when he signed the executive order recently to reimpose his maximum pressure policy on Iran with sanctions and other measures, he sort of lamented the fact that he was doing it and said he hoped he didn't have to use this power because, you know, he wanted the Iranians to come to the table. Of course, an Israeli strike like this would make that almost impossible, would make negotiations almost impossible, and might, if they're unsuccessful in really dealing a serious setback to Iran's nuclear program, as I think is a very strong possibility, might even spur the Iranians to say, okay, that's enough. We're going to, you know, make a weapon, you know, and foreclose on whatever further possibility there is of preventing that from happening. So, you know, if Trump were to approve this, he would be taking a pretty provocative step toward, I think, more conflict, because, of course, then the U.S. would have to get involved, because it's been U.S. policy that we will not allow Iran to develop a nuclear weapon. And, you know, things could go very, could spin very quickly out of control. So, you know, have to see how he reacts to that.
Good stuff. Great stuff. Let's move on to China, where Trump has been making tariff moves.
Trump, as you know, shortly after taking office, he imposed tariffs on imports from Canada, Mexico, and China. He then suspended the tariffs on Canada and Mexico for at least a month after getting some, I think, fairly limited concessions from both of those governments. The tariffs on China have remained in place and took effect shortly after he signed that executive order. There was some hope that there would be a discussion, negotiation between Trump and Xi Jinping, maybe, you know, a phone call or something. The same type of conversation that Trump had with Claudia Sheinbaum of Mexico and Justin Trudeau in Canada that got those tariffs suspended. There has not been a conversation like that. And indeed, there's some speculation that Xi was offended by the fact that Trump signed the executive order imposing the tariffs, and then they went into effect fairly quickly. The theory being that he was hoping to force Xi into making some emergency kind of panicked concessions to keep the tariffs from coming into effect. And if that's the case, if he does feel offended, then that's going to make diplomacy more difficult. I will say that Trump on Friday eliminated or walked back one part of the tariffs that he had imposed on China. Danny, I'm sure you're familiar with this as a big drop shipper, the de minimis exemption, which
money through Alibaba, yeah, for sure.
Small dollar purchases, small dollar imports under $800 were previously not subject to tariffs. Trump eliminated in his executive order, eliminated that exemption. So anything coming in now is subject to tariffs. What wound up happening was that the U.S. Postal Service at one point just stopped taking packages from China, because the burden of trying to collect import duties on all of these packages was overwhelming to an institution that's really not set up to do that. And so Trump on Friday walked back that piece of it. He restored the de minimis exemption. It was not really about, I think, you know, doing anything, making a concession to China so much as just conceding that the logistical challenge of suddenly dumping this in the post office's lap was just not workable.
Thanks, Derek. Let's talk about Sudan, where the military seems to be close to driving the RSF out of the Khartoum region.
Yes, the Sudanese military over the weekend announced a number of new advances in that region. And they captured a neighborhood in the city of Bahri, also known as Khartoum North, that had previously been under the control of the Rapid Support Forces Group. It's unclear to me if the RSF still has any foothold in Bahri, which at one point they largely controlled. But the military in recent weeks has really swept through this area. If the RSF still has any presence in Bahri, it's relatively small. The military has been advancing for several days on the Republican Palace, which is located in central Khartoum. It was the home residence of the president of Sudan prior to all of this, prior to the conflict between the military and the RSF. They're also advancing on Khartoum from the south. There was, over the weekend again, the military announced that it had taken a town called Abu Kuta, which is in Jazeera State. As I say, looks like they're moving north from Wad Madani, the capital of Jazeera, which they captured several weeks ago, moving north into Khartoum, which puts the RSF forces that remain in the capital at risk of being surrounded, essentially. So it really does look like a tenuous position at this point for the RSF in the capital. The military is reportedly making plans to roll out a whole new government and make a really big deal once, I guess, they have the Republican Palace in hand, or feel like they've driven the RSF out of the capital altogether, to make a big, you know, kind of political statement about the country being, you know, back under military control. That doesn't change the situation in other areas that the RSF, where the RSF has a fairly strong position, particularly in Darfur, where they've captured almost the entire region except for the city of Al-Fashir, which is still under siege. But the momentum has been pretty clearly on the military side for some time now.
Let's move over to Somalia, where our old friends at the Islamic State seem to be back.
Yeah, this is something that's been going on for a few weeks now. There's been this surge of activity in Somalia's Puntland region, which is a semi-autonomous part of Somalia and happens to be home to the Islamic State Somalia branch, which hitherto hasn't gotten all that much attention. It's been, you know, considered kind of small, not terribly relevant, not terribly active. All of a sudden, there's a lot of reporting, and the Puntland government and the Somali government, to some extent, although this is really, as I say, it's an autonomous region, and the government has been really spearheading this with U.S. support, air support in particular, kind of going after IS positions, bases, killing, you know, dozens in some cases of militants at a time. And we're getting reporting, like there was a piece in the Washington Post this week about how powerful the Somali IS branch suddenly is and how wealthy it is. It's making so much money that it's able to kind of send funding out to other IS branches around the world. It's attracting a lot of foreign fighters that, you know, and now could pose a threat to targets in the West, not just in Somalia, but could be a threat internationally. I think it's interesting that, you know, we're 3 weeks into the second administration of Donald Trump, who in his first administration withdrew almost all U.S. forces from Somalia. It's a little interesting that suddenly, you know, like U.S. Africa Command and other sources are talking about how, you know, powerful and potent this is Somali IS branches, and gosh, we need to do something about them. I'm not saying that they're wrong or that they're, you know, that this is definitely a smokescreen, but it does seem like interesting timing to me to have this all coming out now.
Thanks, Derek. Let's stay in the region and move over to the Democratic Republic of Congo. And let's start with this regional summit, which has demanded a ceasefire.
Over the weekend, an emergency summit of the East African Community and the Southern African Development Community, two regional blocks that kind of intersect around in the Congo region, they met to discuss the conflict between the Congolese military and the M23 militant group / Rwandan military, which is in there supporting them, and demanded basically and what they called an immediate and unconditional ceasefire. They announced plans for all the regional military chiefs to get together within 5 days and draw up the terms of such a ceasefire. Notably, there was no comment from either the Congolese government or M23 or Rwanda about whether or not they were actually going to abide by a ceasefire, if this was just some sort of statement of aspiration. Turns out to have been pretty much a statement of aspiration. There were M23 did take a couple of days. The things in the Eastern DRC seemed pretty quiet at the beginning of the week. But Tuesday, M23 reportedly launched a new attack near the town of Kavumu, which is located in South Kivu province in the Eastern DRC. It's home to an important military airstrip, so there's a logistical concern here. And it's also around 70 kilometers outside of Bukavu, which is the capital of South Kivu province, where the militants seem to be heading. They captured two more towns in South Kivu on Wednesday, and the Congolese government then called for another emergency meeting of the two blocs, the Southern African Development Community and the East African Community, maybe to talk about whatever happened to that ceasefire that they proposed a few days ago, which clearly didn't come into fruition. I think there are some concerns here, not just for all the displaced people, and there are, you know, hundreds of thousands at this point displaced in the Eastern DRC. Thousands have been killed, particularly when M23 entered and seized Goma. You know, there's talk of 3,000, maybe more than that at this point, people who were killed in that operation. Aside from what's happening inside the Democratic Republic of the Congo, there are concerns at this point about things expanding into a regional war. And the likeliest factor for that would be if the Burundian government gets involved here in a major way. Now, Burundi does have military forces in the eastern DRC. They have engaged in fighting with M23 and Rwandan forces. Burundi and Rwanda are not on great terms anyway. They have their own problems with one another. And there have been some threats from Burundian officials that, that they could escalate this into a conflict between those two countries, which would take things, I think, to another level. So that's the big kind of long-term concern, let's say, or longer kind of timeline concern. The immediate concern, obviously, is with the fighting and the displacement inside the DRC.
So let's conclude with the greatest country on the goddamn earth, and that's the United States. And let's talk about these new steel and aluminum tariffs that Trump has instituted.
Trump signed another executive order on Monday imposing across-the-board 25% tariffs on aluminum and steel imports. There are no exemptions at this point, although Trump has suggested he would be open to hearing pleas from other countries. The Australian government has made one, regarding steel, its steel products. So anybody who wants to plead for favorable treatment could approach Trump, I guess, and supplicate themselves.
What countries will those go on?
Everybody. Steel.
Including Canada and Mexico?
Yeah. Any steel coming into the United States is going to have a 25% tariff.
What about aluminum, sir?
Aluminum, too.
He's also supposed to roll out at some point, I think. There was some talk he might do it on Wednesday, and now he might do it on Thursday. We're recording this, of course, on Thursday, but I haven't seen any indication that he's done it yet, that he might roll out another set of tariffs. These would be basically reciprocal tariffs, one of the things that he's talked about doing for some time now, essentially raising U.S. tariffs to match the tariffs that other countries have on particular classes of U.S. products. That would probably raise some howls as well. The European Union is affected. The EU trade ministers are supposed to meet, are supposed to be meeting. They might already be meeting at this point to discuss responses, retaliations to what Trump has done. But it affects, obviously affects imports from all over the world. So we can expect some combination of retaliation and groveling from those reciprocal tariffs as well.
Good news. And let's conclude with exciting new opportunities for corruption. So, Derek, what's going on in this country of ours?
Well, Danny, I know you're a big believer in the Transparency International's Corruption Perceptions Index, and I'm sad to
definitely.
Say that the United States fell to a tie for 28th in the world in the 2024 Corruption Perceptions Index rankings with a score of just 65 out of 100. The report cited a lot of concerns about the integrity of the U.S. court system, which I can't fathom what with, Clarence Thomas taking plane rides everywhere on billionaire private jets. I can't imagine what they would be talking about.
I see no problem with that, Derek.
Yeah, it seems fine. It seems fine. But I think what is more interesting here potentially is the opportunities for corruption that we're going to have moving forward. Trump has taken a number of measures to essentially decriminalize corruption. He ordered his attorney general, Pam Bondi, earlier this week to stop enforcing the 1977 Foreign Corrupt Practices Act, which makes it illegal for U.S. nationals to bribe foreign officials. That should be fun. He's also decriminalized, or Bondi is decriminalizing much of the conduct that previously would have gotten you dinged under the Foreign Agents Registration Act. So according to Bondi, they will continue to prosecute what she called instances of alleged conduct similar to more traditional espionage, but they're not going to prosecute unregistered lobbying and other more commonplace forms of corruption. So another vector for things to get really fun in D.C., I think. There was also a report in Bloomberg on Wednesday that the administration is planning to take billions of dollars from the now almost basically defunct U.S. Agency for International Development and sock them into the U.S. International Development Finance Corporation, which functions more as a private entity or public-private entity. It uses public funds to backstop private sector finance projects. This is ostensibly supposed to be used for development finance, but there's some speculation that Trump could use this office to basically backdoor his way into the sovereign wealth fund that he wants to create, which would mean the development idea or that any of this is going to go to any, you know, even ostensibly humanitarian purpose is out the window. And this is just going to be a public sector investment vehicle. And you can imagine the potential for just outrageous levels of corruption here is massive. I don't want to prejudge anything. I'm sure we all have the best of intentions. We'll see how it goes.
Derek, I love a good public-private partnership, so I'm really looking forward to these new developments. Thank you, everyone, for listening. Check out the YouTube, subscribe to us, join the Discord, and as always, keep on rocking in the free world. Bye.
Bye.
Hair thinning can happen for so many reasons. Whether it's stress or hormones or anything, at Nutrafol, we've learned that real change starts below the surface. Our hair growth supplements take a whole body approach and target the key root causes of hair thinning, so you can see visibly thicker, stronger hair in 3 to 6 months.
Hair growth starts from the inside at Nutrafol.com. That's Nutrafol.com.